Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
In the time it takes me to make these remarks, more than 100 people will lose their lives to COVID-19.
As the Delta variant spreads rapidly around the world, Africa is in its deadliest phase, where vaccines are in their shortest supply. Then,
we said yes to reparations, we said yes to repair.
Evanston, Illinois becomes the first U.S. city to issue slavery reparations. Is this the beginning of something, or just a one-off? Plus,
I was shocked at just internally how many Facebook employees have been trying to do good, have been trying to tell their bosses that they see major problems and major issues.
An ugly truth. Reporters Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kong reveal the design behind Facebook's darker side. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The raging debate here in Europe over vaccines just entered a whole new phase. Today, lawmakers in France took dramatic action, approving a new rule to require special health passes for restaurants, cinemas, as well as domestic travel and other inside spaces. Shunning a readily available vaccine is a luxury Africa doesn't have, where less than 2% of people there have received a single dose. Meanwhile, here in the UK, almost 60% are fully vaccinated. Despite all the talk and promise of vaccine sharing, in fact, the rich world has hoovered up over 80% of the global supply. But this week, Africa finally starts receiving doses of Johnson & Johnson's offering. With such a woeful lack of supply, the continent is also experiencing its deadliest wave. Matshidiso Moeti is the WHO's regional director for Africa. The veteran doctor was pivotal in the fight against HIV/AIDS across the continent. And Sir Jeremy Farrar, the infectious disease specialist, UK government COVID advisor, and author of Spike, the virus versus the people, an insider's account of the pandemic response, is joining me. Welcome, both of you, to the program. Can I ask you first, Jeremy Farrar, as you analyze and watch the pandemic responses, you see what the president of France is gambling on, a whole new law to insist on vaccine passports. Can I have your, you know, initial response to that?
We've got to do all we can to try and encourage everybody to be vaccinated and provide vaccines around the world in an equitable way. We're not doing it well. The UK has done remarkably with the vaccine rollout, and actually vaccine hesitancy in the UK has historically been very low. But in France, in Italy, in Spain, and in other countries, US, vaccine hesitancy, people not wanting to have the vaccine, has been very much higher. I'm personally much more in favor of trying to persuade and communicate and educate and try and persuade people for public health measures. But sometimes if that's not working, I can see why France is taking the idea that you've got to encourage more. You've got to maybe even force people to have the vaccines. But I think your introduction to this section was so important. Most of the world does not have access to vaccines. It's not about vaccine hesitancy. It's about vaccine apartheid, frankly, and vaccine inequity. And I think that is really the most important global issue.
Well, I'm sure your term vaccine apartheid resonates with Dr. Moeti. So we've established that 80% of the global supply has been hoovered up by those who produced it, the rich nations who made self-interest more important than sharing despite their promises. What is the actual on-the-ground situation? We've said you're in your deadliest wave in Africa. You have the least amount of supply. What are you seeing in front of your very noses right now there, Dr. Moeti?
Yes, it is a deadly combination. In fact, we've had for the last 2 months, 8 weeks, a straight increase in cases every week. And we've had also an increase in deaths, which has just started to slow down. And we've seen at the same time in June a virtual stopping of availability of vaccines in Africa. So we had only 450,000 doses of vaccine available for 1.3 billion people in Africa in the month of June. And we're starting to see also populations getting very tired of the measures of prevention, masks, distancing, and so forth. So all of this is really a perfect storm for a third wave, which is unprecedented. It's 80% higher already than the previous wave that we had on the continent. It's a serious situation, and we believe it hasn't peaked yet. We've just had Eid in our Muslim-believing countries, and we need to anticipate that what that will do in terms of cases and, unfortunately, deaths in Africa.
So Johnson & Johnson, which is the one dose vaccine, is sending doses to you, or at least I think the US is sending some 6 million doses. Honestly, it's a drop in the ocean. Even 20 million doses is a drop in the ocean. All the things that they've promised are drops in the ocean. What do you think you can do with those drops right now? Will they make a difference? Do you even have the capacity to administer them, Dr. Moeti, around the continent?
Yes, they will make a huge difference. And it's very encouraging to start to see the doses being delivered in countries now. And we express our appreciation, particularly to the US government, which has been the quickest in terms of delivering higher volumes of doses. We've seen our countries be capable of delivering the doses that they've received. In the first round of doses, countries like Rwanda, Ghana, Botswana, Lesotho, even Angola, made very good use and reached high coverage and used up a high proportion of the doses that they received. We're very concerned that having had this gap, this pause, our countries in the latter part of this quarter and late in the year will start receiving doses, and we need to really help them to gear up in several ways to, you know, microplan, make sure that they've got first the vaccine delivery sites, the ways of registering people. There have been some challenges, assuming that elderly African people have mobile phones and have a connection to be able to register. So being more creative and going where people go in order to register them, and then mobilizing the capacity of the extra healthcare workers that will be needed to deliver, making sure the funding is there. The World Bank is offering, the African Development Bank, the Afrexim Bank are offering money, and we need our countries to access this money and organize really solid delivery campaigns. And as WHO, we're there to support them. So That's a huge effort that now has to come on board.
Okay. So let me ask you from your perspective, Jeremy Ferrer, because as you've all said, you know, as long as one country or one area in the world is not vaccinated and healthy, it'll affect everybody else. In other words, it's all for one and one for all in terms of protection. So what is your nightmare scenario? Because we know that the Congo had to throw away, or the Democratic Republic of Congo had to throw away more than a million doses because they couldn't administer them before they expired. What is your fear if Africa cannot be protected?
Well, Dr. Moeti's being, you know, characteristically diplomatic there. I mean, the issue is frankly not about rolling out. Yes, every country, Europe, North America, has its own challenges in rolling out, but you can't roll out what you don't have access to. And the biggest problem is access. And I'm afraid, frankly, US, yes, applaud the generosity, but they are very small amounts. And the world needs to get 10 or 11 billion doses available around the world in the coming weeks and months. And why it's so important is, yes, it's about saving lives. Yes, it's about preventing illness. Yes, it's about taking off the pressure of the health system and making sure healthcare workers and the vulnerable are protected. But it's also in all of our self-interests, because if we don't do this and we have high transmission around the world, then new variants will come. We've already seen Alpha. We've seen Beta. We're now learning what it means when you have a highly transmissible Delta variant that takes off in every country. There will be new variants if we allow transmission to continue at its current rate or even get higher. And so it's enlightened self-interest. It's public health and scientifically the right thing to do, as well as morally and ethically. And we've got to step up. The G7, the G20 countries have got to stop talking about whether countries can roll it out and start making them accessible to the vaccines that everybody needs.
I want to ask you whether you were surprised, Jeremy Ferrer, as one of the originators of the whole notion of COVAX and sharing and all the rest of it, That self-interest amongst the rich countries prevailed, that the basic human nature prevailed. And we've got more than we can deal with and surplus and all the rest of it. Are you surprised by that?
Yeah, I am surprised. I think the circumstances change. So, you know, being charitable, a year ago, 6 months ago, people were talking about vaccinating 30% of their population. With the Delta variant, you know, frankly, that is 70, 80, 90% of population. So I appreciate circumstances have changed, but we made some mistakes in May of 2020, frankly. We didn't build in the manufacturing capacity around the world. We didn't transfer the technologies quickly enough, the manufacturing capacity and the rollout and the vaccines. And so therefore, I'm afraid the countries that can manufacture it have inevitably, understandably, kept it amongst their populations. But I just stress, it's in enlightened self-interest to make these vaccines available. And applaud WHO and the government of South Africa recently for the work with Johnson & Johnson and with others to shift the manufacturing capacity to the continent of Africa. But Africa is suffering, but it's not just Africa. Indonesia, Vietnam, Brazil, Mexico, all countries at the moment who don't have access to the vaccine are going through very similar to what you heard Dr. Moiti describing in Africa. And that will go on and on and on. And the variants that arise will come back to the US, come back to Europe, come back to the United Kingdom.
Okay, before I discuss or ask you how we deal with those recurring issues, I want to ask Dr. Moiti, do you believe that it is possible for Africa, or at least some countries, some are already in the supply chain, but to actually start being self-sufficient? Because many of your leaders in the continent say, we cannot, look, this is shown, we cannot be dependent on the so-called charity or kindness of friends. It's just not delivered. And we need to start manufacturing. You're an expert in this public health domain. Is that something that's possible in any reasonable period of time?
No, you know, I think the ambition is laudable, and frankly, it's timely. We've been talking about local production of medicines in Africa for years now. I don't think it's going to make a difference soon. I don't think this is an alternative to the dose sharing that is being requested, for example. So, you know, it's one thing to transfer technology, set up an agreement with a company. You need to create the market. You need to find the financing if this is going to be something that's viable beyond the initial support from international partners. People need to invest that believe they're going to make a profit if they put their money into this venture, so that, you know, the market shaping is very important to do. You need to create the capacities to train the people. And the very idea of the technology transfer and suspending intellectual property rights is also a big hurdle to overcome. There's huge negotiations that are needed there. So this is something that's going to take some time to happen. And I believe that the kind of determination being shown at the political level by African governments needs to be, again, translated into action. At the moment, it's a very strong statement of intent, which we are very thankful for in Africa, but we need to see it translate into a very united action, relying on each other, cooperating between countries in order for this to become something that's going to be feasible going into the future.
Jeremy Ferrer, can you translate for us? We are all non-experts, at least I speak for myself, when it comes to assessing the efficacy of the vaccine and the perniciousness of the variants. You know, many people are getting hysterical saying, oh, they told us the vaccines would make it work and that we wouldn't have to worry. And now look, all these people who are double vaccinated here in the rich part of the world are still coming down with the Delta variant. Can you just tell us where we stand with this variant, and are the vaccines by and large efficient or not, and in what way?
Yeah, the last question, the last point is perhaps the most important. The vaccines, and I would include all of the registered vaccines available, are incredibly safe and incredibly effective at preventing us getting ill, going to hospital, and tragically dying. And that remains true against the Delta variant. The vaccines have never been as good against stopping me getting infected. So they may be 60 or 70%, 75% effective against me getting infected, but they're very good, 90, 95% against me getting sick, going to hospital, and dying. And that is something that we need to celebrate. and to appreciate that if you get double vaccined or the single dose with Johnson & Johnson, you are protected from getting sick and dying. Now, inevitably, it's not 100%. And so there will be a very small number of people, 3 or 4%, maybe 5% of people double vaccinated who, yes, will get sick and go to hospital, but even they will be protected against dying as well. So I can't stress how strongly it is that the vaccines remain incredibly safe and highly effective, particularly against getting sick, hospitalization, and dying, including against the Delta variant. And I think that is perhaps the most important message of all.
And I just want to play what the French president addressed specifically to the vaccine hesitance, the vaccine hostiles, the people who are just frankly not doing it. All the scientists, well, most of the respectable scientists, are saying that lockdowns don't work anymore. It is the vaccine. This is what President Macron said about this.
That is not freedom. That is called irresponsibility. It is called selfishness. A society only holds together when the freedom of each person is respectful of the other, and therefore it is based on rights and duties.
Let me put it to you, Dr. Moeti. When you see the French president, you know, taking on the vaccine hostility, certainly in his country and elsewhere, and you see people in your continent, you know, desperate for the vaccines, what is your reaction to that?
Well, you know, frankly, I find it very sad and even annoying. It's sad. We are looking for every vaccine dose that we can get. And by the way, we do have here as well vaccine hesitancy. I like the word vaccine hostility because I've seen some very angry people screaming about how they have the right to refuse a vaccine, forgetting that then they are endangering everybody else. So it's ironic and it's sad. And I think we need to work against it at all levels, in all countries. Like Jeremy, I believe the best way is to persuade and teach people. But we do in every country have provisions of public health law that at some point, if it is deemed highly important, can be enacted and can be enforced. It's a desperate last move. But I'm very sad when I see, you know, not only people going to football matches while we are struggling to get vaccine here, but those who have the opportunity to have a vaccine not accepting it. That's infuriating and sad.
So Jeremy, you have written a book, basically, Spike, the virus versus the public. It's about the pandemic response. You know, everybody says it should, you say it should be persuasion and modeling and this and that. But let's face it, there are rules. We have to wear seatbelts. We can't drive while drunk. We have to, you know, sometimes in the past, we actually had to have vaccines and we carried around yellow passes to show that we could travel, you know, yellow fever and all the rest of it. It's not unusual to have these mandatory situations. So what do you think in your book and how you've looked at the vaccine response is the biggest issue as an insider? What sort of, I guess, went wrong in terms of getting people to step up once the miracle of the vaccine was produced?
Yeah, I think public health always, mate has just said it. I mean, public health always works best through trust, through good communication, education, information. And that's the best way of bringing any society along with your rules. But you're absolutely right. Seatbelts is a good example. We mandate them, certainly in most countries. And I think there does come a point, Dr. Moeti said, when the public health imperative trumps the individual hesitancy. I don't think we're at that in most countries, frankly. I think we could still move further into the vaccine hostile, the vaccine hesitant people by providing the information, by providing role models of all ages that can say, look, vaccines are safe, they're highly effective, and we can't control this without them. But I would just call back on one thing that came up earlier, that you said it's lockdowns and restrictions and physical distancing no longer work, it's all about vaccines. Public health works by adding these things together. Some degree of physical distance, the wearing of masks, the vaccines, these are additive together. They shouldn't be seen as one or the other. There aren't, I'm afraid, magic bullets. Vaccines exist and will benefit people when they're put in the context as well with other measures like wearing a mask, like some degree of physical distancing and being sensitive to your surrounding community and population.
Of course, and thank you for that correction. Jeremy Ferrer and Dr. Moeti, thank you very much for joining us today. Now, as America continues to reckon with the lingering effects of its original sin, slavery, One city is trying to atone for past discrimination by making reparations available to some of its black residents. Evanston, Illinois, is the first in the country to do so, and it's now working out how best to make payouts because of its Jim Crow policies. Robin Rue Simmons, who chairs the city's reparations committee, proposed the program, and I'm also joined by the British theologian and professor Robert Beckford, who documents the legacy of colonialism and slavery right here in the UK. Thank you both for joining me. Let me start with you, Robin Rue Simmons. How did it come about? You are the first city close to Chicago to implement this. What were the building blocks that enabled you to get as far as you have?
Well, you're absolutely right. We are a North Shore city just north of Chicago. And we have, like most other cities in America, anti-Black practices and policies that sustain our racial divide here in Evanston. And what we had was our racial gaps. We had a $46,000 household income divide between Black and white Evanston, disparities in every other area. But we also had good efforts in equity and inclusion. We had a chief equity officer. We had done a lot of work towards sustaining equity, but not enough, or really not anything, to repair the egregious acts from the city of Evanston to the Black community, which we found in housing and zoning law.
So just to be clear, you are focusing almost exclusively on housing and the zoning laws, right? And if that is the case, how does the reparation manifest itself?
So actually, this is our first step. In 2019, November of 2019, we passed Resolution 126R19 to commit to reparations for our Black community, establishing a fund with our first $10 million of cannabis sales tax. And through a community process, our community weighed in on what forms of reparations the Black community would like to prioritize. There were many recommendations, but housing was the priority because it was a consensus of our feedback that was within our purview. Much of the feedback really was the responsibility of our healthcare system or our education system. But the city of Evanston has laws on its books that were enforced until fair housing was passed that were anti-Black and stripped away wealth and opportunity. So we have prioritized housing first, being informed by our community appropriately. And we have 96% of our fund remaining and a commitment from the Reparations Committee and the City Council to grow that fund and expand the programming. So we understand that the road to repair is long, it is tireless, and we understand that we have to take a first step. This is the first step that we've taken, fully understanding that full repair is going to include the need to address our policy and other forms of compensation and restitution and rehabilitation. But we are taking our first tangible step with housing, and it will repair the damages done because it will immediately build wealth for Black families that were stripped away from having that opportunity through housing equity. $25,000 of housing equity translates into wealth that can be accessed to age in place for seniors to use that equity to send children to college or even pay down a mortgage balance. So it's building wealth. More importantly, it's also building a sense of place for our Black community. We've had an exodus. We're down to less than 17% of the population when we had been in the mid-20s before. But lack of affordability and a sense of place has declined our Black population. And this will begin to repair families that have been injured by building wealth, building a sense of place, strengthening the voice, and committing to continuing the road to repair here in Evanston.
Okay. Well, look, it sounds like a really exciting, I think we can say experiment right now, right? Because you're the first in the country, and I'm going to ask you in a bit about whether it can be spread out around the country. But I want to ask you, Professor Beckford, you're listening to this. At least there's an acknowledgement there that there is historic, systemic, obvious, you know, racism and the need to repair. What do you think, since you've documented this for a long time and the idea of reparations here in the UK, when you hear what we're listening to from Evanston and how far are you coming, if at all, here in the UK?
Well, first of all, I think we should celebrate and affirm what's happening in Illinois. It is truly a historic first step. The situation in Britain is slightly different. We're looking at reparations for the transatlantic slave trade and the brutalization of Africans who were enslaved in the British West Indies, 3 to 4 million people that we can account for. What's happened since the tragic death of George Floyd is an awakening, an awareness by industry in Britain with slavery links, an awareness by families with slavery links that they have to atone and make amends for the unjust enrichment that they benefited from as a consequence of their involvement in the transatlantic slave trade. So the situation is slightly different. We're looking at what took place in the British West Indies and looking at reparation for that particular context. The awakening has had implications already. We've seen that the University of Glasgow has acknowledged that it had slavery links and has offered to pay £20 million in reparation to the West Indies. We know that Lloyds Bank, Lloyds Shipping, and also Green Flag, the drinks company, acknowledged that they have slavery in their economic DNA and want to do something about it. We know there are other banks, other institutions, making these kind of assessments. And I'd expect that in the next months to come, we'll hear some major announcements by major institutions about how they're going to make amends.
You know, in the United States, some of this is taken up in Congress as well. It's not, you know, reached its conclusion, obviously, but it has been taken up there. Here in the UK, there seems to be an opposite reaction. The current Conservative government, particularly senior ministers, have talked about gesture politics, have denied in a report that there is any systemic rigging of the system against blacks or other minorities, and seems to be working in the opposite direction to talk about seeing history in its full 360 degrees, so to speak. Does that concern you? I mean, I ask you because you're the brain power behind the documentary Empire Pays Back, which found that Britain would have to pay £7 trillion in reparations for its part in the transatlantic slavery trade.
Look, I think we have to remember that the major export from the transatlantic slave trade is racism. It's still very much with us. It's a part of our everyday lives. And unfortunately, it finds its way into government. We know that since the 1950s, when black people have been here in large numbers, that structural racism has been an everyday feature of black people's lives. That's something you can't wash away through a weak and a politically motivated report, such as the Sewell report, or the failure by leading conservative ministers with slavery links to acknowledge that they benefited unjustly. You know, I think that the weight of history is with those who have been campaigning since the 1950s for reparation for the transatlantic slave trade. I think that we are at a pivotal moment, a tipping point, where industry, government, and maybe in the royal family, with the changes in the demographics of the royal family, maybe now they will also acknowledge their links with the slave past and make amends. So I think that there is just too much force. There's just too much going on in terms of a positive sense that change needs to take place to address the past. And that can't be withheld or stopped by the recent denials by the Conservative Party and the Sewell report to suggest that racism isn't an everyday part of our lives. But we need to also disentangle the two. Although systemic racism is a product of the past, what we're attempting to do with reparations is deal with a particular historical injustice and the morality of that cause, which is just.
Can I ask you a personal question in terms of your family, Robin Ruth Simmons? What were the particular Jim Crow policies that affected your family?
Well, you know, I'm a native Fifth Ward resident, and by default, my family was restricted to living in the West End of the Fifth Ward due to policies that impacted segregation here in Evanston. So we were not allowed access to the same opportunity, not allowed access to the same education. We are the only neighborhood in Evanston that doesn't have a neighborhood school. Today, still, we do not have access to healthy food. We're registered as a food desert. We had a hospital in our neighborhood, community hospital, that was closed. And these amenities, community amenities, have never returned. And we see the consequences today. We see it in our household income. We see it in our declining homeownership rate. That's lower than it was before fair housing was passed in 1968. We see it in our education outcomes, our achievement gap. And so that was the experience that I had, being bused to public schools here in Evanston and not having the same livability and access to opportunity as my white classmates and my white friends here in this city. And that continues today. In 2021, we're still racially segregated. I still live in the neighborhood in which I was born and raised, and it's still the predominantly Black community with the most concentrated poverty and the least access to all amenities and community assets as well. And we are changing that. In passing reparations in 2019, there is the heart and will among our city to begin the road to repair. Our legislation is unique to the city government. It's a municipal reparations, but institutions, organizations, businesses, our faith community has really stepped up in our city as we continue to advance our municipal reparations policy.
Can I ask you just to address some of the critics? There will always be critics, and some in the community are saying that the money that you're talking about is going to not go back to the banks, but it's going to be administered or whatever to some of the banks who were probably complicit in the first place. The amount is not enough to right the profound wrongs, and the amount should be in cash for whatever people want to spend it on. What are your answers to that?
My answer to that is I could not agree more that the amount is not enough. But this is the beginning of the work. It is a first step. It's a tangible step. It's $10 million more than any other American city has set aside for the harms in their Black community. But we are beginning the work. So the answer to that is join the work. Let's advocate to expand the fund and expand the programming. The concern about the benefit going to the banks, the wealth goes to the family. Equity in a home is wealth for a family. And how that family chooses to use their equity or wealth is their privilege and it is their right. We do not have purview over the banks. And to that point, we have been working very hard to partner with a bank that will provide reparation benefits, including financial products and services that complement our goals for reparations here in Evanston. It is unlikely that any resident, our Black community or any other, is paying cash for a home. And then in terms of it being a cash benefit, our focus on housing was informed by our community. It's also directly connected to the injury that we have here in housing and zoning laws. So it makes it a very viable case for reparations. We had a direct harm related to housing impact and wealth being stripped away, and we have a direct remedy that responds to that harm. And I believe that's what's allowed us to accelerate our goals for reparation beyond theory into practice, beyond celebration or ceremony into something actually tangible. So agreeing that it's not enough, but celebrating our city for taking a first important step, one that has been uncomfortable and unprecedented, but one that we have committed to, and we are committed to building on the work.
Before I turn to you, Robert Beckford, I want to play an illustration of what Robin is telling us, and that is about the housing. And HBO last week tonight with John Oliver this week just showed stark examples of this complete historic injustice that Robin's talking about. A Black family called the Bruces owned extremely valuable land in Manhattan Beach, I believe it is. And the city took it away under the guise of eminent domain in the 1920s. This is John Oliver's response to that.
There is pretty obviously only two ways of making this right. Give the Bruces $20 million or give them their land back. And incredibly, the latter might actually happen. Because LA County, which owns the land, recently released a plan for returning it to the Bruces, which is, to put it mildly, about time. It's literally been called Bruce's Beach since 2006. Is the apostrophe S a joke to you people? It indicates possession.
Sir Robert Beckford, a British export, you know, showing, his moral outrage in America. I guess I want to ask you for your reaction to that issue, but also, can you tell me how it's manifesting itself here in the UK, given it's a different situation? But the descendants, those who were caught up in this, you know, historic injustice of the slave trade, what are the worst impacts here in the UK for them?
Well, firstly, I think the Bruce's breach situation is tragic, and it's reproduced right across America. So it's not an isolated incident. The taking of wealth of African Americans in the 18th and 19th century was part of the white supremacist project. It's absolutely tragic. In Britain, it's slightly different. We're looking at a post-war situation where colonial citizens from the West Indies, whose ancestors were enslaved by the British, come to Britain and experience British racism. So we're dealing not only with the impact of slavery in the Caribbean and making amends for that, but also dealing with the way in which racism has manifested itself within British society, particularly the way in which it affected African Caribbean subjects. We can look at how it's impacted in terms of education. We know that when there is a marking, for example, at universities or schools where names are shown, that African Caribbean people score lower than their white counterparts. We know that for a long period in British post-war history, there have been issues around racialized housing, where black and brown people have not received the best housing that was available to them. We also know that employment and in, for example, is another area where racialized oppression has manifested itself. So we're looking at two spheres of influence here. We're looking at one, the West Indies, and how reparation is made from the unjust gain there, and also its continuity in new forms of racialized oppression within contemporary Britain.
And we'll keep watching. Both of you, thank you so much for joining us. Robert Beckford, Robin Ruth Simmons, thank you so much. And we will see whether Evanston remains a lone holdout or whether your example will carry on around the US, Robin. Thank you so much. Now,
thank you.
Whether it's conversations around race or COVID-19, social media has helped spread distrust, division, and misinformation. The White House has taken on the social media giants, with YouTube the latest to face its wrath. Now, a new book called An Ugly Truth by reporters Celia Kang and Shira Frankel reveals what they claim are Facebook's deliberately dark strategies in its battle for domination. Here they are speaking to Hari Srinivasan.
Christiane, thanks. Shira Frankel, Cecilia Kang, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start with kind of the tension that's bubbling right now between Facebook, the administration, and really everyone, which is the disinformation and misinformation about vaccines that's spreading right now. We know that the majority of the people who are in hospitals and dying today, as we record this interview, are all unvaccinated. And for a big subsection of that population, they get their news from social media. And again, a larger subsection of that, they'd probably say they heard it on Facebook. The administration has tried to turn up the heat on Facebook and tried to say there is responsibility here. Cecilia, let me start with you. What responsibility does Facebook have to police the misinformation and disinformation about vaccines on its platform?
Yeah, Hari, the White House sees misinformation about the COVID vaccines as the last hurdle to solving the pandemic. And they believe that Facebook has a lot more within their control than they're exercising in controlling this misinformation spread. So there is responsibility in that it is the biggest social media platform. And when the White House asks Americans, why aren't they getting vaccinated? As you said, they say that they learn about misinformation. They learn theories about the harms of the vaccines that are false, often on Facebook. Facebook says that it is trying and it does have absolutely responsibility. But the question is, how hard are they trying to actually clamp down on the spread of misinformation? Not only the efforts that they do in trying to promote authentic information, but what are they actually doing on the misinformation side?
Shira, one of the responses that Facebook had to the administration was, look, we have done all this good. We have connected so many millions of people to good information about vaccines, about where they can get a shot. This is the kind of stuff that we're doing as a social media platform. But at the same time, you know, I interviewed Imran Ahmed months ago, and the Center for Countering Digital Hate had put out this report that showed how literally a dozen people are responsible for, 70%+ of the misinformation that's happening on their platform. So is Facebook not reading that report? Are they in denial? What do you hear?
You know, that report has been out for some time from the Center for Countering Digital Hate. It shows that, you know, over 65% of it is being seen on social media. And people within Facebook have absolutely seen that report. I think what it shows, and really it's a pattern that repeats itself in our book, is that Facebook is often quite, you know, reactive rather than being proactive about these problems. Instead of at that point, perhaps contacting the White House themselves or launching a plan and saying, right, here's the 12 people, here's what we've already done, here's what we hope to do to collect more data on how misinformation spreads, they sort of, you know, continued with their status quo. And what we know from our own reporting is that they reached a point last week where the White House was asking them for information they just didn't have because they had not set up those systems that could track how far misinformation was spreading about the COVID vaccine on their platforms.
President Biden recently accused Facebook of killing people. He kind of walked back that statement a little bit, but what is something that government can or should do to try and stop misinformation?
You know, I think the government often gets lost in very specific discussions about really specific pieces of misinformation. And in a way, that's missing the forest for the trees here. You know, there are a lot of questions around, you know, what pieces of individual content can be moderated, or even specific people, as we saw the White House list that disinformation doesn't. Instead, the White House could be having a discussion about why does Facebook still recommend that people join anti-vaccine groups? Why does Facebook's algorithm still push you into those groups if you join one? I yesterday went and joined one group that was, you know, natural cures for the common cold. And within one click, Facebook's algorithms were pushing me into a group that was anti-vaccine. Now, if I was the White House, I would be having discussions with Facebook about that, which is something that they've already said they want to change and do differently. And so I would be thinking more about how does Facebook as a platform spread that movement rather than individual players within that movement.
Cecilia, you know, whether it is information or misinformation about the vaccines, whether it's about groups that are organizing to plan an insurrection against the Capitol, I mean, time and time again, what you detail in this book is that there are these deliberations between people inside Facebook, and Facebook took intentional actions that did change the view for billions of people of what they saw. I mean, they sort of proved that it was possible that they could turn the dials, so to speak, or flip some switches and change things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was really an important moment for us in discovering, as we were reporting this book, that Facebook has a lot of power within its control, and that they keep this from the public, that they're not transparent about how they do turn those dials. In that instance, they had decided to change the rankings of the newsfeed to prioritize more authoritative sources like news outlets, like CNN, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, et cetera. And that actually put and surfaced more authoritative news to the top of the newsfeed. It shows that there is within their control this particular pattern. And it also, so it shows importantly that they're not explaining and revealing to the public what they're doing. But another very important pattern that we discovered is that oftentimes Facebook's these big decisions are made by a small group of people within Facebook, and particularly the CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, who has really seized so much more control, not just on the technology, but on these really important policy decisions over content and speech and the spread of misinformation online.
Maybe this is a overly simple or overly complex question, but what determines on Facebook what it is that I see versus what it is that you see?
This is a really key takeaway that we hope our readers of the book will learn from, which is that Facebook is a public square with algorithms that surface the most emotive content to the top of news feeds, and those algorithms also direct its users to groups and other pages based on their activity. And the algorithms always bias toward the most emotive content. And what I mean by that is content that spurs some sort of emotional reaction, be it anger or fear, happiness, what have you. But that kind of content gets you to like, to put an emoji on some sort of post you see, and to share. And that's the kind of engagement that Facebook needs, very importantly, to feed its business. The Facebook is in the business of gathering your data based on how much input you put into the company, the site, how much engagement you have on the site. And so the analogy of it being a town square is not quite right. We have somebody quote in our book, Renee DiResta, who's quite smart on this, who really aptly says, freedom of speech does not mean freedom of reach. And the reach part is where the algorithms comes out. And that's how Facebook differs from any other communications platform that we've seen in history.
You know, Shira, one of the things that's interesting is that if you go with this notion that Facebook can moderate and turn down things, say, for example, under the threat of imminent violence, right? That our protections of political speech or free speech are going to apply less if you're threatening the lives of someone or threatening some violence. Well, that if they can do that in America, well, what about the rest of the world that's using Facebook in some cases to actually cause harm on groups of people? I mean, we've seen this play out, whether it's in Sri Lanka or India or Myanmar.
I'm so glad you asked that. I mean, we have a whole chapter in our book about Myanmar because that really is the worst case scenario, where Facebook launched into a country which didn't have a local and free press. It didn't have NGOs and civil disobedience groups which could openly counter some of that hate speech that began to run rampant on Facebook. And we saw what happened. Facebook in that country had one content moderator that spoke just Burmese, they weren't even in the country, who was responsible for moderating all of the content from that country, Myanmar, where over 100 languages are spoken. And, you know, in Myanmar, we obviously know that led to a genocide, but it's looking across the world in most countries, Facebook just doesn't have the same teams of content moderators. They don't have people that speak every language in Indonesia, for instance, or in India for that matter. And so the question begs, you know, how do you responsibly, responsibly make yourself the preeminent social media company in the world, launching into all these countries over the world, without giving the same kind of resources to content moderators to make sure that whatever you're doing here in the United States, being on top of the hate speech, being on top of elections, you can responsibly do that in every country where you've launched.
Cecilia, you both write a lot about the relationship between Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg, and in a way, how she came in really to juice up the business, but also balance some of the strengths and weaknesses that Mark had. But in the past couple of years, we've seen Sheryl less and less. What is her status within the company right now from the folks that you're in touch with who are still there?
Yes. I mean, I think there's two ways to look at her status right now. First of all, she still leads an incredibly important part of the business, which is the actual revenue creation, the profit center, which is the advertising business. And she is, by all accounts, internally and by shareholders, a great success. The company's thriving, $85 billion in revenues and a $1 trillion valuation. She has, however, run up against Mark Zuckerberg's need or concern about all the public fallout over all the scandals at Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg has taken over a lot of the responsibilities that early on in their relationship, he left to her because he frankly thought they were not interesting. They're not interesting responsibilities over policy, communications, legal, security, for example. So he has lost some confidence in her, as well as taken over more control of those kinds of roles. So her role on the other part of the business that's very public facing and really deals with the issues and Facebook at the intersection of society and politics are much more influenced by his decision making. We understand that she's become much more isolated.
I want to quote a response that Facebook had to your book. It says, this book, quote, tells a false narrative based on selective interviews, many from disgruntled individuals, and cherry-picked facts. The fault lines that the authors depict between Mark and Sheryl and the people who work with them do not exist. All of Mark's direct reports work closely with Sheryl and hers with Mark. Sheryl's role at the company has not changed. Shira, do your sources tell you otherwise?
They do. And I mean, I would point out that we spoke to over 400 people for this book. The vast majority of them still work at Facebook. We didn't in any point in time go seeking disgruntled ex-employees. We went seeking people who were in the room, who witnessed their relationship firsthand and could speak to it. And I think that if Facebook were to be honest about its upper echelons, it would say that quite a few people have been hired at the very top and that they currently do jobs within the company that used to be handled by Sheryl Sandberg. And more to the point, Mark Zuckerberg currently does many of the jobs that were once handled by Sheryl Sandberg. And so her role has very much changed.
The time period that you are looking at during this is also the rise of Donald Trump to be president and the actions that his administration takes. And you repeatedly have employees in there speaking up and challenging hate speech, racist speech, but repeatedly the company seems to side with the politics of the day, taking that into account as well as the business side of it. So you see these kind of deliberations and you say, well, wait, is that separate from what we're actually looking at? And why does the politics matter so much? There's almost a false equivalence when they publish and say, here's some things that we've taken off from the right. Oh, here's also some things that we've taken down from the left.
Right. I mean, we see them sort of taking this political calculus into effect really at the start of Trump's campaign for president, making this decision ultimately that they will carve out an exception for Donald Trump. And that's a decision early on made really quite ad hoc, which kind of haunts them through the Trump presidency. And this idea that grows among conservatives, that there's a conservative bias within Facebook. Facebook constantly tries to fight against that by really, you know, making quite a few decisions out of fear of upsetting more conservatives. I think one moment that I remember quite vividly was when they decide to take down QAnon, which is a very far right fringe conspiracy movement. And its security team makes this recommendation of, here are the QAnon groups we really think we should remove. We think it's really important to national security that we remove these groups. And they're essentially told by the policy team to wait and to find groups on the left, which would be somehow equivalent, that they could take down at the same time so that Facebook could announce a larger takedown that wasn't just a far right groups. And it takes them several weeks to come up with this kind of bigger list. To me, that was a key moment where they're showing, well, they're slowing down action they need to take just to create some kind of really, well, false equivalence so that the right wing media doesn't spin it as, oh, they only took down a certain sort of type of group on the platform.
Cecilia, you have covered technology in Washington a while, and you know that administrations change and things go into favor and out of favor. But here we are now, perhaps because of how Facebook was used in the campaign against Hillary Clinton for the ascension of Donald Trump, the left seems far less enthused. The shine has come off Silicon Valley a little bit for them. And then on the right, you have political conservatives saying that our speech is being squelched. So it almost seems like a sort of a strange bedfellows moment where you have some bipartisan agreement that there needs to be something done. And at the same time, you have an administration that has staffed up folks that are really been paying attention to antitrust. They've been paying attention to kind of the spread and the power of social media. With all of that going for change, is it likely that anything will change for Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that change will have to come from the outside. I don't think you're going to see change from internally. Mark Zuckerberg's not stepping down anytime soon, and he doesn't have accountability inside. From the outside, it will take some time, but there is incredible enthusiasm and energy right now in Washington. And as you said, Republicans and Democrats are united in their real desire to rein in big tech companies like Facebook. There's going to be some obstacles, even though you have Jonathan Cantor, who was appointed to the DOJ, Lina Khan at the FTC, and people like Tim Wu at the White House, who are very vocal big tech critics and who have called for the breakup of big tech companies. They're still encumbered in some way by courts, as well as the Supreme Court, as well as other courts, as well as the lack of legislation that really can fit internet companies into a filter of enforcement action today. This is laws that were created during the big oil and big steel days. And so there are some big challenges ahead, but I think if history is a guide, it's inevitable. It's inevitable that these companies with so much power and dominance won't see some sort of regulation at some point.
What's the most, you know, surprising or disturbing thing that you learned when you were doing this reporting? Shira, let me start with you.
You know, I think it was just how many people tried to sound the alarm. For me, especially in the Myanmar chapter, to have someone in their own offices telling them a genocide is not just likely, it's probably going to happen if you don't change something. This is someone in their building in Menlo Park telling them this. And to have the company still not take action. I myself was shocked at that. I was shocked at just internally how many Facebook employees have been trying to do good, have been trying to tell their bosses that they see major problems and major issues. And I think all of us should sort of be aware that there are really good people who work within the company who are trying to do better. It's just unfortunate that they're often not listened to.
Cecilia?
One of the things that surprised me the most is how this is so much Mark Zuckerberg's company. I mean, I think I suspected that in the beginning, but to hear that he was making calls on a doctored video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and he was making the calls on the former president calling for Americans to drink bleach and to take UV lighting to cure COVID, and that he was saying that those posts should remain up. I mean, that was actually surprising to me to hear that he was, in many ways, the final decider on these really important decisions.
The book is called An Ugly Truth Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Authors Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mahari.
And finally, away from Facebook tonight, let us hear it for the underdogs. The British diver Tom Daley has finally struck gold on his fourth Olympics after winning the men's 10-meter synchronized diving with Matty Lee, himself a first-time Olympian. In the women's skateboarding, three teenagers with a combined age of 42 swept the medals. In swimming, the Tunisian Ahmad Hafnaoui upset the favorites and powered to gold in the 400-meter freestyle. And last but not least, in basketball, France has beaten the heavy favorites, the United States of America, ending their impressive 17-year winning streak. And that is it for now. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.